Chapter 17. Away. At 3:20, Dune took his pillowcase pack, left the school by the back door, and started up Pibb Street. He went fast. The lights had gone out for a few minutes just before 3, and he was nervous about being outside. He planned to take the long way to the pipeworks, out at the very edge of the city, to avoid any guards that might still be looking for him. He was filled with dread about Lina. He wouldn't know what had happened to her until he got to the pipeworks, and she either showed up or didn't. All he could do now was run. He raced down Knack Street. It was strange to be out in the city with the streets so utterly deserted. Without the people passing back and forth, the streets seemed wider and darker. Nothing moved but himself, his shadow, and his fleeting reflection in shop windows he passed. In Selverton Square, he saw a kiosk where the poster with his and Lina's names on it had been pinned up. Everyone in the city must have seen these posters by now. He was famous, he thought wryly, but not in the way he'd wanted. There would be no glorious moment on the gathering hall steps after all. Instead of making his father proud, he would cause him dreadful worry. This thought made him so sad that his knees felt suddenly wobbly. How could he just vanish without a word? But it was too late now. He couldn't go back. If only there was some way to send him a message. And in a moment, he realized there was. He stopped, fished in his pack for the paper and pencil he had brought, and scribbled on it, "Father, we have found the way out. It was in the pipeworks, after all. You will know about it tomorrow. Love, Dune." He folded this in quarters, wrote, "Deliver to Loris Harrow," in big letters on the outside, and pinned it to the kiosk. There. That was the best he could do. He would have to trust that someone would deliver it. In the distance, he heard the faint sound of singing. He listened. It was the song of the river just ending. Far below, like the blood of the earth, from the center of nowhere, rushing forth, he sang under his breath. Like everyone in Ember, he knew the words of the three songs by heart. He sang along softly with the faraway singers. Making the light for the lamps of Ember, older than anyone can remember, faster than anything anyone knows, the river comes and the river goes. Up Rim Street now to River Road, he was halfway there. The singers were starting on the Song of Darkness. It was his favorite, with its powerful deep harmonies. He was a little sorry to be missing it. He went up the Pott Street side of empty River Road Square, where another poster hung crookedly on the kiosk, and he was headed toward North Street when suddenly the lights flickered and went out. He jolted to a stop. Stand still and wait. That was his automatic response. In the distance, he heard a dip in the sound of the singing, some startled voices breaking the flow, but then the song rose again, defying the darkness. For a moment, all thoughts vanished from Dune's mind. There was nothing but the fearless words of the song. Black as sleep and deep as dreaming, darkness like an endless night, yet within the streets of Ember, bright and bravely shines our light. He sang, standing still in the blackness. When the song ended, he waited. The lights would surely come back soon. For a few minutes there was silence, and then far away, but piercingly clear, he heard a scream. More screams and shouts followed, the sounds of panic. He felt the panic himself, like a hand taking hold of him, making him want to leap up and fling himself against the dark. But suddenly, with a flash of joy, he remembered. He didn't have to wait for the lights to come back on. He had what no citizen of Ember had ever had before, a way to see in the dark. He set his pack down, untied the knot at the top, and groped around inside until he felt the candle. Down in a corner, he found the little packet of matches. He scraped a match against the pavement, and it flared up instantly. He held the flame to the string on the candle, and the string began to burn. He had a light. He had the only light in the entire city. The candle didn't cast its light very far, but it was enough to see at least the pavement in front of him. He went slowly along Pott Street, then turned left on North Street. At the end of the street was the wall of the Pipeworks office. When he got to the Pipeworks entrance, no one was there. A little cloud of moths came to flutter around the flame of his candle, but otherwise nothing moved in Plummer Square. There was nothing to do but wait. Dune blew the candle out. He didn't want to use it all up in case the light stayed off a long time, and squatted down on the pavement, setting down his bundle and leaning against one of the big trash cans. He waited, listening to the distant shouts. And at last, the lights blinked, blinked again, and came on. Lina was nowhere in sight. If the guards had found her and taken her. But Dune preferred not to think about that yet. He would wait for a while. She would have been delayed by the blackout if she was on her way. He couldn't see the clock tower from here, but it was probably not quite 4 o'clock. What if she didn't come? The singing was over. The people were dispersing throughout the city, and the guards no doubt would soon resume their search for him. Dune clasped his arms together and pressed them hard against his stomach, trying to stop the queasy fluttering. If she didn't come, Dune had two choices. He could stay in the city and do what he could to save Lina, or he could go in the boat by himself and hope Lina could somehow free herself and tell the people of Ember about the way out. He didn't like either of these plans. He wanted to go down the river, and he wanted to go with Lina. Dune stood up and hoisted his sack again. He was too restless to keep sitting. He walked down to Gappery Street and looked in both directions. Not a single person was in sight. He walked to Plummer Street, thinking that perhaps Lina was coming by way of the city's edge, as he had, to avoid being seen. But no one was there. He didn't even see anyone when he went past Subling Street to the very end of the city. He had to decide what to do. He went and stood in the doorway of the Pipeworks. Think, he said to himself, think. He was not even sure he could make the river journey by himself. How would he get the boat into the water? Could he lift it without help? On the other hand, how could he help Lina if she was in the hands of the mayor's guards? What could he possibly do that would not just get himself caught, too? He felt sick. His hands were cold. He stepped out of the doorway and scanned the square once again. Nothing moved but the moths around the lights. And then, down Gappery Street, Lina came running. She came slantwise across the square, and he dashed to meet her. She was hugging a bundle to her chest.
"I've come. I'm here. I almost didn't make it," she said, breathing so hard she could barely talk. "And look!"
She folded back the blanket of her bundle. Dune saw a curl of brown hair and two wide, frightened eyes.
"I've brought Poppy."
Dune was so glad to see Lina that he didn't mind at all that Poppy was coming with them, making a risky journey even riskier. Relief and excitement flooded through him. They were going. They were going.
"Okay," he said. "Come on."
With his borrowed key, he opened the Pipeworks door, and they hurried past the yellow slickers on their hooks and the lines of rubber boots. Dune dashed into the Pipeworks office long enough to replace the key on its hook, and then they pulled open the stairway door and started down. Lina stepped slowly because of Poppy, and Poppy clung to her neck, unusually quiet, sensing the strangeness and importance of what was happening. At the bottom of the stairs, they came out into the main tunnel and walked down the path to the west until they came to the marked rock.
"How are we going to get Poppy down there?" Dune asked.
Lina said,
"I'll fasten her to my chest."
Setting Poppy down, Lina took off the coat and the sweater she was wearing. With Dune's help, she made her sweater into a sling for Poppy, tying its sleeves behind her neck. Then she put her coat back on and buttoned it up. Dune looked doubtfully at this bulky arrangement.
"Will you be able to climb down, carrying her like that? Will you be able to reach around her and hold on to the rungs?"
"Yes," said Lina. Now that she had Poppy with her, she felt brave again. She could do whatever she needed to. Dune went down first. Lina followed.
"Stay very still, Poppy," she said. "Don't squirm."
Poppy did stay still. but even so, it was not easy going down the ladder with her extra weight. Lina's arms were just long enough to reach past Poppy and hold on to the ladder. She descended very slowly. When she got to the ledge, she stepped sideways, gripped the hand Dune held out for her, and with a deep breath of relief, came into the entryway. They walked to the back of the entry hall, and Dune opened the steel panel and took out the key. He slid aside the door to the room where the single boat was, and they went in. Dune took his candle from his sack and lit it. Lina unwrapped Poppy and sat her down at the back of the room.
"Don't move from there," she said.
Poppy put her thumb in her mouth, and Dune and Lina set to work. Dune's sack went in the pointed end of the boat, which they decided must be the front. They put the boxes of candles and matches into the rear of the boat. It was clear they'd been designed to go there. They fit snugly. The poles labeled paddles were a mystery. Lina thought maybe they were weapons, meant for fending off hostile creatures. Dune thought they might fit across the boat somehow, to make railings to brace yourself against, but he couldn't get them to work in this way. Finally, they decided just to leave the paddles in the bottom of the boat and figure out what they were for as they went along. Dune dripped a bit of wax on the floor and stood his candle up in it so he'd have both hands free.
"Let's see if we can lift the boat," he said.
With Dune at the rear and Lina at the front, they found they could lift the boat with ease. It was amazingly light, even with the boxes and pack inside it. They set it down again. The next step was to get it in the water somehow, and then get in it themselves.
"We can't just drop it in," Lina said. "The river would grab it right away."
"That must be what the ropes are for," said Dune. "We lower it in by holding on to the ropes, and tie the ropes to something to keep it from moving."
"To what?"
"They must have put a peg or something in the wall to tie it to."
Dune went back out to the edge of the river and got down on his knees. Leaning over, he felt with one hand along the bank below. At first, there was only smooth, slippery rock. He moved his hand slowly back and forth, up and down. River water splashed against his fingers. At last he felt something. A metal rod attached to the river wall, like the rungs of the ladder they had climbed down.
"I found it," he called.
He got up again and went back to the boat room.
"Let's carry the boat out," he said.
He and Lina lifted it, and taking small steps, moved it forward. As they went out the door, Poppy began to wail.
"Don't cry," Lina called to her. "Stay right there. We'll be back in a second."
They carried the boat right to the edge of the water and set it down carefully, its front end pointing downstream. Dune knelt again, feeling for the metal rod.
"Hand me the end of the rope," he said.
"Which rope?"
Lina thought for a second. She realized it had to be the one attached to the side of the boat nearest her. That would be the side closest to the riverbank when they put the boat in. She uncoiled the rope, ran it around the boat, and handed its end down to Dune, who lay on his stomach with his head hanging over the edge and knotted the rope to the metal rung in the wall. He got to his feet again, wiping water from his face.
"Now," Dune said, "we can put the boat in the water."
Another wail came from the boat room.
"I'm coming,"
Lina called and dashed back for Poppy. She hoisted her up and spoke into her ear, in the voice she used for announcing an exciting game.
"We're going on an adventure, Poppy. We're going for a ride. A ride in the water. It will be fun, sweetie, you'll see."
She blew out the candle Dune had left and carried Poppy to the river's edge.
"Are we ready?"
said Dune.
"I guess we are. Goodbye to Ember," Lina thought. "Goodbye to everyone. Goodbye to everything."
For a second, a picture of herself arriving in the bright city of her dreams flashed into her mind, and then it faded and was gone. She had no idea what lay ahead. She set Poppy down against the wall of the entry passage.
"Sit here," she told her. "Don't move until I tell you to."
Poppy sat, her eyes wide, her plump legs sticking out in front of her. Lina took hold of the rope at the rear of the boat. Dune took hold of the rope at the front.
They heaved the boat up and stretched sideways to swing it out over the water. It tipped alarmingly from side to side.
"Let it down!" yelled Lina.
They both let the rope slide through their hands, and the boat fell and hit the water with a slap. It bounced and rocked and pulled against its tether, but Dune's knot held. The boat stayed in place, waiting for them.
"Here I go!"
Dune cried. He bent over, gripped the rim of the boat with one hand, turned backward, and stepped in. The boat tipped sideways under his weight. Dune staggered a step and then found his balance.
"All right," he yelled. "Hand me Poppy!"
Lina lifted Poppy, who began to howl and kick at the sight of the bucking boat and the churning water. But Dune's arms were right there, and Lina thrust her into them. A second later, she jumped in herself, and then all three of them were tossed to the floor of the boat by its violent rocking. Dune managed to get to his feet. He hauled on the rope that held the boat to the bank until he was close enough to reach the knot. He struggled with it. Water splashed into his face. He yanked at the knot, loosened it, pulled the rope free, and the boat shot forward. Chapter 18, Where the River Goes. For a second, Lina saw the banks of the river streak by. Ahead was the opening of the tunnel, like an enormous mouth. They plunged into it and left the light of the pipeworks behind. In complete darkness, the boat pitched and rolled, and Lina, in the bottom of it, banged from side to side, gripping Poppy with one arm and grabbing with the other hand for anything to hold on to. Dune slid into her, and she slid into the boxes. Poppy was shrieking wildly.
"Dune!"
Lina shouted, and he shouted back, "Hold on! Hold on!" But she kept losing her grip on the edge of the boat and being flung sideways. She was terrified that Poppy would slam into the metal bench or be torn from her arms and tossed into the river. The boat hit something and shuddered, then raced on. It felt like being swallowed, this rushing through the dark with the river roaring like a thousand voices. Lina's legs were tangled with Dune's, and Poppy's arms were so tight around her neck that she could hardly breathe. But it was the dark that was most terrible, going so fast into the dark. She closed her eyes. If they were going to smash into a wall or plunge into a bottomless hole, there was nothing she could do about it. All she could do was hold tight to Poppy. She did that for what seemed a long time. And then at last, the current slowed, and the boat stopped thrashing about so wildly. Lina managed to sit up, and she felt Dune moving, too. Poppy's shrieks turned to whimpers. The darkness was still complete, but Lina sensed space above and around her. Where were they? She had to see.
"Dune," she said, "are you all right? Can you find us a candle?"
"I'll try," Dune said.
She felt him scramble past her to the back of the boat, and she heard a scrape as he pulled a box out from its place under the bench.
"Can't find the latch," Dune said.
Then a second later,
"There, I've got it. This is the matches, so this one must be candles."
More scraping and banging. The boat lurched. Lina slid forward. Dune slid too and slammed into her back. He gave a yell of rage.
"Dropped a match! Hold on, I almost had it!"
Long seconds of scrambling and clattering. Then a light flared up, and Dune's shadowed face appeared above it. He touched the match to a candle, and the light grew steadier. It was only a small flame, but it cast glints of light on the tunnel walls and the silky surface of the water. The tunnel had an arched ceiling, Lina saw, like the tunnels of the pipeworks, but it was much wider than those tunnels. The river ran through it like a moving road.
"Can you light another?" Lina asked.
Dune nodded and turned back to the boxes, but once again the boat struck something, causing a spray of water to slap into them and put the candle out. It was several minutes before Dune managed to light it again, and more before he finally had two burning at once. He jammed one of them into a space between the bench and the side of the boat, and he held the other in his hand. His hair was flattened against his forehead and dripping. His brown jacket was torn at the shoulder.
"That's better," he said.
It was better. Not only did they have light to see by, but the current was slower, and the boat sailed more smoothly. Lina was able to unwrap Poppy from her neck and look around. Ahead, she could see that the tunnel curved. The boat swung into the curve, banged against the wall, straightened itself, and sped on.
"Hand me a candle, too," she said.
Dune gave Lina the candle he was holding and lit another. They found places to wedge all three candles into the frame of the boat so they could keep their hands free. For a while, they rushed along almost silently, the river having become nearly as smooth as a sheet of glass. Then suddenly, the current slowed even more, and the tunnel opened out.
"We've come into a room," said Lina.
Far overhead arched a vaulted ceiling. Columns of rock hung down from it, and columns of rock rose from the water, too, making long shadows that turned and mingled as the boat floated among them. They glimmered in the candlelight, pink and pale green and silver. Their strange, lumpy shapes looked like something soft that had frozen. Like towers of mashed potatoes, Lina thought, that had hardened to stone. Now and then, the boat bumped into one of these columns, and they found that they could use a paddle to knock themselves free again. In this way, they crossed the room to the other side, where again the passage narrowed and the current ran faster. Much faster. It was as if the boat were being pulled forward by a powerful hand. The water grew rough again, and splashes of spray put out their candles. Lina and Dune huddled in the bottom of the boat with Poppy between them, their arms clasped around her. They clenched their teeth and squeezed their eyes shut. And soon, there was nothing in their minds but the roll and plunge of the boat, and nothing in their bodies but the effort not to be thrown out. Once, the sound of the river rose to a crashing, and the front of the boat tipped downward, and they were pitched about so violently that it seemed they were tumbling downstairs. But that lasted only a few seconds, and then they were streaming onward as before. Lina lost track of time. But a while later, maybe a few minutes, maybe an hour, the current slowed. The candles they'd stuck in the boat had been knocked overboard, so Dune lit new ones. They saw that they had come to another pool. There were no lumpy columns of rock here. Nothing interrupted the wide, flat surface of the water, which stretched out before them in the flickering light from their candles. The ceiling was smooth, and only about 10 feet above their heads. The boat drifted, as if it had lost its sense of direction. Using a paddle to poke against the walls, Dune guided the boat around the edge of the pool.
"I don't see where the river goes on," said Dune. "Do you?"
"No," said Lina. "Unless it's there, where it flows into that little gap."
She pointed to a crack in the wall only a few inches wide.
"But the boat can't go there."
"No, it's much too small."
He pulled the boat forward. Their shadows moved with them along the wall.
"Want to go home," said Poppy.
"We're almost there," Lina told her.
"We certainly can't go back the way we came," said Dune.
"No."
Lina dipped a hand in the water. It was so cold, it sent an ache up her arm.
"Could this be the end?" said Dune.
His voice sounded flat in this closed-in place.
"The end?"
Lina felt a shiver of fear.
"I mean, the end of the trip," Dune said. "Maybe we're supposed to get out over there."
He pointed to a wide expanse of rock that sloped back into the darkness on one side of the pool. Everywhere else, the walls rose straight out of the water. He pulled the boat over to the rock slope. The boat scraped bottom here. The water was shallow.
"I'll get out and see if this goes anywhere," said Lina. "I want to be on solid ground again anyway."
She handed Poppy to Dune and stood up. Holding a candle, she put one foot over the edge of the boat and into the cold water, and she waded ashore. The way did not look promising. The ground sloped upward, and the ceiling sloped downward. As she went farther back, she had to stoop. A few yards in, A tumbled heap of rocks blocked the way. She inched around them, turning sideways to squeeze through the narrow space, and crept forward, holding the candle out in front of her. This goes nowhere, she thought. We're trapped. But a few steps farther along, she found she could stand up straight again, and a few steps beyond that, she turned a corner, and suddenly the candlelight shone on a wide path, with a high ceiling and a smooth floor. Lina gave a wild shout.
Here it is, she cried. It's here. There's a path.
Dune's voice came from far away. She couldn't tell what he was saying. She made her way back toward the boat, and when it came in sight, she yelled again,
I found a path! A path!
Dune scrambled out and waded ashore, carrying Poppy. He set her down, and then he and Lina took hold of the boat and hauled it as far as they could up the slope of rock. Poppy caught the excitement. She shouted gleefully, waving her fists like little clubs, and stomped around, glad to be on her feet again. She found a pebble and plunked it into the water, crowing happily at the splash it made.
I want to see the path, said Dune.
Go up that way, Lina told him, and around the pile of rocks. I'll stay here and take things out of the boat.
Dune went, taking another candle from the box in the boat. Lina sat Poppy down in a kind of nook formed by a roundish boulder and a hollow in the wall.
Don't move from here, she said.
Then she pulled Dune's bundle from under the seat of the boat. It was damp, but not soaked. Maybe the food inside would still be all right. She was hungry all of a sudden. She'd had no dinner, she remembered. It must be the middle of the night by now, or maybe even morning again. She carried Dune's bundle ashore, along with the boxes of candles and matches, and as she set them down, Dune came back. His eyes were glowing, the reflection of a tiny flame dancing in each one.
That's it for sure, he said. We've made it!
Then his eyes shifted.
What's Poppy got? He asked.
Lina whipped around. In Poppy's hands was something dark and rectangular. It wasn't a stone. It was more like a packet of some kind. She was plucking and pulling at it. She lifted it to her mouth as if to tear it with her teeth, and Lina jumped to her feet.
Stop! She shouted.
Poppy, startled, dropped the packet and began to cry.
It's all right. Never mind, Lina said, retrieving what Poppy had been about to chew on. Come and have some dinner now.
Hush, we're going to have dinner. I'm sure you're hungry.
In the light of Dune's candle, with Poppy squirming on Lina's lap, they examined Poppy's find. The packet was wrapped in slippery greenish material and bound up with a strap. It wasn't wrapped very well. It looked as if someone had bundled it up quickly. The material was loose and blotched with whitish mold. Lina edged the strap off carefully. It was partly rotten. On the end of it was a small square buckle covered with rust. She folded back the wrapping. Dune took a sharp breath.
It's a book, he said.
He moved his candle closer, and Lina opened the brown cover. The pages inside had faint blue lines across them, and someone had written along these lines in slanted black letters, which were not neat like the writing in the library books, but sprawling, as if the writer had been in a hurry. Dune ran his finger under the first line.
It says, they tell us we learn... No, leave. They tell us we leave tonight.
He looked up and met Lina's eyes.
Leave? Said Lina. From where?
From Ember? Dune asked. Could someone have come this way before us?
Or was it someone leaving the other city?
Dune looked down at the book again. He riffled through the pages. There were many of them.
Let's save it, said Lina.
We'll read it when we get to the new city.
Dune nodded.
It'll be easier to see there.
So Lina wrapped up the book again and tied it securely into Dune's bundle. They sat on the rock shelf for a while, eating the food Dune had brought. The candles wedged in the boat still shone steadily, and their light was cozy, like lamplight. It made golden shapes on the still surface of the pond.
Dune said,
I saw the guards run after you. Tell me what happened.
Lina told him.
And what about Poppy? What did you tell Mrs. Murdo?
I told her the truth. At least, I hope it's the truth. I caught up with her on her way home after the singing. She'd seen the posters. She was terrified. But before she could ask questions, I just said she must give Poppy to me. I said I was taking her to safety. Because that's what I suddenly realized on the roof of the gathering hall, Dune. I'd been thinking before that I had to leave Poppy because she'd be safe with Mrs. Murdo. But when the lights went out, I suddenly knew. There is no safety in Ember. Not for long. Not for anyone. I couldn't leave her behind. Whatever happens to us now, it's better than what's going to happen there.
And did you explain all that to Mrs. Murdo?
No. I was in a terrible hurry to get to the pipeworks and meet you, and I knew I had to go while there were still crowds in the street, so it would be harder for the guards to see me. I just said I was taking Poppy to safety. Mrs. Murdo handed her over, but she sort of sputtered, "Where and why?" And I said, "You'll know in a few days. It's all right." And then I ran.
"So you gave her the note then?" said Dune. "The one meant for Clary?"
"Oh." Lina stared at him, stricken. "The message to Clary."
She put her hand in her pocket and pulled out the crumpled piece of paper.
"I forgot all about it. All I was thinking of was getting Poppy and getting to you."
"So no one knows about the room full of bolts?"
Lina just shook her head, her eyes wide. "How will we get back to tell them?"
"We can't."
"Dune," said Lina, "if we told people right away, even just a few people, if we hadn't decided to be grand and announce it at the singing..."
"I know," said Dune. "But we didn't, that's all. We didn't tell, and now no one knows. I did leave a message for my father, though."
He told Lina about pinning his last-minute message to the kiosk in Selverton Square.
"I said we'd found the way out and that it was in the pipeworks, but that's not much help."
"Clary has seen the instructions," Lina said. "She knows there's an egress. She might find it."
"Or she might not."
There was nothing to be done about it, and so they put the supplies back into Dune's pillowcase and got ready to go. Lina used Dune's rope to make a leash for Poppy. She tied one end around Poppy's waist and the other around her own. She filled her pockets with packs of matches, and Dune put all the remaining candles in his sack in case they arrived in the new city at night. He filled his bottle with river water, lit a candle for himself and one for Lina, and thus equipped, they left the boat behind and crept up the rocky shelf to the path. Chapter 19. A World of Light. As they squeezed past the rocks at the entrance to the path, Dune thought he saw the candlelight glance off a shiny place on the wall. He stopped to look, and when he saw what it was, he called out to Lina, who was a few steps ahead of him.
"There's a notice!"
It was a framed sign bolted to the stone, a printed sheet behind a piece of glass. Dampness had seeped under the glass and made splotches on the paper, but by holding their candles up close, they could read it. "Welcome, refugees from Ember. This is the final stage of your journey. Be prepared for a climb that will take several hours. Fill your bottles with water from the river. We wish you good fortune. The Builders."
"They're expecting us," said Lina.
"Well, they wrote this a long time ago," Dune said. "The people who put it here must all be dead by now."
"That's true. But they wished us good fortune. It makes me feel as if they're watching over us."
"Yes, and maybe their great-great-great-grandchildren will be there to welcome us."
Encouraged, they started up the path. Their candles made only a feeble glow, but they could tell that the path was quite wide. The ceiling was high over their heads. The path seemed to have been made for a great company of people. In some places, the ground beneath their feet was rutted in parallel grooves, as if a wheeled cart of some kind had been driven over it.
After they had walked a while, they realized that they were moving in long zigzags. The path would go in one direction for some time, and then turn sharply and go the opposite way. As they went along, they talked less and less. The path sloped relentlessly upward, and they needed their breath just for breathing. The only sound was the light pat-pat of their footsteps. Lina and Dune took turns carrying Poppy on their backs. She had gotten tired of walking very soon and cried to be picked up. Twice they stopped and sat down to rest, leaning against the walls of the passage and taking drinks from Dune's bottle of water.
"How many hours do you think we've been walking?" Lina asked.
"I don't know," Dune said. "Maybe two, maybe three. We must be nearly there."
They climbed on and on. Their first candles had long ago burned down to the last inch, as had their second candles. Finally, when their third ones were about halfway gone, Lina began to notice that the air smelled different. The cold, sharp-edged rock smell of the tunnel was changing to something softer, a strange, lovely smell. As they rounded a corner, a gust of this soft air swept past them, and their candles went out. Dune said,
"I'll find a match."
But Lina said, "No, wait. Look." They were not in complete darkness. A faint haze of light shone in the passage ahead of them.
"It's the lights of the city," breathed Lina.
Lina set Poppy down.
"Quick, Poppy,"
she said, and Poppy began to trot, keeping close at Lina's heels. The strange, lovely smell in the air grew stronger. The passage came to an end a few yards farther along, and before them was an opening like a great empty doorway. Without a word, Lina and Dune took hold of each other's hands, and Lina took hold of Poppy's. When they stood in the doorway and looked out, they saw no new city at all, but something infinitely stranger. A land vast and spacious beyond any of their dreams, filled with air that seemed to move, and lit by a shining silver circle hanging in an immense black sky. In front of their feet, the ground swept away in a long, gentle slope. It was not bare stone as in Ember. Something soft covered it, like silvery hair, as high as their knees. Down the slope was a tumble of dark, rounded shapes, and then another slope rose beyond that. Way off into the distance, as far as they could see, the land lay in rolling swells, with clumps of shadow in the low places between them.
"Dune!" cried Lina. "More lights!"
She pointed at the sky. He looked up and saw them. Hundreds and hundreds of tiny flecks of light, strewn like spilled salt across the blackness.
"Oh!"
he whispered. There was nothing else to say. The beauty of these lights made his breath stop in his throat. They took a few steps forward. Dune bent to feel the strands that grew out of the ground, almost higher than Poppy's head. They were cool and smooth and soft, and there was dampness on them.
"Breathe," said Lina.
She opened her mouth and took in a long breath of air. Dune did the same.
"It's sweet," he said. "So full of smells."
They held their hands out to feel the long stems as they waded slowly through them. The air moved against their faces and in their hair.
"Hear those sounds?" said Dune.
A high, thin, chirruping sound came from somewhere nearby. It was repeated over and over, like a question.
"Yes," said Lina. "What could it be?"
"Something alive, I think. Maybe some kind of bug."
"A bug that sings?"
Lina turned to Dune. Her face was shadowy in the silver light.
"It's so strange here, Dune, and so huge. But I'm not afraid."
"No, I'm not either. It feels like a dream."
"A dream, yes. Maybe that's why it feels familiar. I might have dreamed about this place."
They walked until they came to where the dark shapes billowed up from the ground. These were plants, they discovered, taller than they were, with stems as hard and thick as the walls of houses, and leaves that spread out over their heads. On the slope beside these plants, they sat down.
"Do you think there is a city here somewhere?" Lina asked. "Or any people at all?"
"I don't see any lights," Dune said. "Even far off."
"But with this silver lamp in the sky, maybe they don't need lights."
Dune shook his head doubtfully.
"People would need more light than this," he said. "How could you see well enough to work? How could you grow your food? It's a beautiful light, but not bright enough to live by."
"Then what shall we do, if there's no city and no people?"
"I don't know. I don't know."
Dune didn't feel like thinking. He was tired of figuring things out. He wanted to look at this new world and take in the scent of it and the feel of it and figure things out later. Lina felt the same way. She stopped asking questions, drew Poppy onto her lap, and gazed in silence at the glimmering landscape. After a while, she became aware that something strange was happening. Surely, when she had first sat down, the silver circle was just above the highest branch of the tall plant. Now, the branch cut across it. As she watched, the circle sank very slowly down until it was hidden, except for a gleam of brightness behind the leaves.
"It's moving," she said to Dune.
"Yes."
A little later, it seemed to her that her eyes were blurring. There was a fuzziness in the sky, especially around the edges. It took a while for her to realize what was making the fuzziness.
"Light," she said.
"I see it," said Dune. "It's getting brighter."
The edge of the sky turned gray, and then pale orange, and then deep fiery crimson. The land stood out against it, a long black rolling line. One spot along this line grew so bright they could hardly look at it. So bright, it seemed to take a bite out of the land. It rose higher and higher until they could see that it was a fiery circle, first deep orange and then yellow, and too bright to look at any longer. The colors seeped out of the sky and washed over the land. Light sparkled on the soft hair of the hills and shone through the lacy leaves as every shade of green sprang to life around them. They lifted their faces to the astonishing warmth. The sky arched over them, higher than they could have imagined, a pale, clear blue. Lina felt as though a lid that had been on her all her life had been lifted off. Light and air rushed through her, making a song, like the songs of Ember, only it was a song of joy. She looked at Dune and saw that he was smiling and crying at the same time, and she realized that she was, too. Everything around them was springing to life. A glorious racket came from the branches. Tweedling notes, peeps, burbles, high sharp calls. Bugs? Wondered Dune, imagining with awe the bugs that could make such sounds. But then he saw something fly from a cluster of leaves and swoop down low across the ground, making a clear, sweet call as it flew.
"Did you see that?" he said to Lina, pointing. "And there's another one. And there."
"There, there, there, there," repeated Poppy,
leaping from Lina's lap and whirling around, pointing in every direction. The air was full of them now. They were much too large to be insects. One of them lit nearby on a stem. It looked at them with two bright black eyes, and opening its mouth, which was pointed like a thorn, sent forth a little trill.
"It's speaking to us," said Dune. "What could it be?"
Lina just shook her head. The little creature shifted its claw-like feet on the stem, flapped its brown wings, and trilled again. Then it leapt into the air and was gone. They leapt up too, and threw themselves into exploration. The ground was alive with insects, so many that Dune just laughed in helpless wonder. Flowers bloomed among the green blades, and a stream ran at the foot of the hill. They roamed over the green-coated slopes, running, sliding, calling out to each other with each new discovery, until they were exhausted.
Then they sat down by the entrance to the path to eat what was left of their food. They untied Dune's bundle, and Lina suddenly cried out,
"The book! We forgot about the book!"
There it was, wrapped in its blotched green cloth.
"Let's read it out loud while we eat," said Dune.
Lina opened the fragile notebook and laid it on the ground in front of her. She picked up a carrot with one hand, and with the other, she kept her place on the scribbled page. This is what she read. Chapter 20, The Last Message. Friday. They tell us we leave tonight. I knew it would be soon. The training has been over for nearly a month now, but still it feels sudden. It feels like a shock. Why did I agree to do this? I am an old woman, too tired to take up a new life. I wish now that I'd said no when they asked me. I have put everything I can into my one suitcase. Clothes, shoes, a good wind-up clock, some soap, an extra pair of glasses. Bring no books, they said, and no photographs. We have been told to say nothing ever again about the world we come from. But I am going to take this notebook anyhow. I am determined to write down what happens. Someday, someone may need to know. Saturday. I went to the train station yesterday evening, as they told me to, and got on the train they told me to take. It took us through Spring Valley, and I gazed out the window at the fields and houses of the place I was saying goodbye to. My home, and my family's home for generations. I rode for 2 hours, until the train reached a station in the hills. When I arrived, they met me. 3 men in suits, and drove me to a large building, where they led me down a corridor and into a big room full of other people, all with suitcases, most with gray or white hair. Here we have been waiting now for more than an hour. They have spent years and years making this plan. It's supposed to ensure that, no matter what happens, people won't disappear from the Earth. Some say that will never happen anyhow. I'm not so sure. Disaster seems very close. Everything will be all right, they tell us. But only a few people believe them. Why, if it's going to be all right, do we see it getting worse every day? And of course, this plan is proof that they think the world is doomed. All the best scientists and engineers have been pulled in to work on it. Extraordinary efforts have been made. Efforts that would have done more good elsewhere. I think it's the wrong answer, but they asked me if I would go. I suppose because I've spent my life on a farm, and I know about growing food. In spite of my doubts, I said yes. I'm not sure why. There are 100 of us, 50 men and 50 women. We are all at least 60 years old. There will be 100 babies, too. 2 babies for each pair of parents. I don't know yet which one of these gentlemen I'll be matched with. We are all strangers to one another. They planned it that way. They said there would be fewer memories between us. They want us to forget everything about the lives we've led and the places we've lived. The babies must grow up with no knowledge of a world outside, so that they feel no sorrow for what they have lost. I hear some noises across the room. I think it's the babies arriving. Yes, here they come, each being carried by one of those gray-suited men. So many of them. So small. Little scrunched-up faces, tiny fists waving. I must stop for now. They're going to pass them out. Later.
We're traveling again, on a bus this time. It is night, I think, though it's hard to be sure because they have boarded up the windows of the bus from the outside. They don't want us to know where we're going. I have a baby on my lap, a girl. She has a bright pink face and no hair at all. Stanley, who sits next to me, holds a boy baby with brown skin and a few tufts of black hair. Stanley and I are the keepers of these children. Our task is to raise them in this new place we're going to. By the time they are 20 or so, we'll be gone. They'll be on their own, making a new world. Stanley and I have named these children Star and Forest. Sunday. The buses have stopped, but they have not allowed us to get out yet. I can hear crickets singing and smell the grass, so we must be in the country, and it must be night. I am very tired. What kind of place can this be, safe from earthly catastrophes? All I can guess is that it must be underground. The thought fills me with dread. I'll try to sleep a little now. Later. There was no chance to sleep. They called us off the buses, and we stepped out into a landscape of rolling hills in full moonlight. That's the way we'll be going in, they told us, pointing to a dark opening in the hill we stood on. Form a line there, please. We did so. It was very quiet, except for the squalling of a few of the babies. If the others were like me, they were saying goodbye to the world. I reached down to touch the grass and breathed deeply to smell the earth. My eyes swept over the silver hills, and I thought of the animals prowling softly in the shadows or sleeping in their burrows, and the birds standing beneath the leaves of the trees with their heads tucked under their wings. Last, I raised my eyes to the moon, which smiled down on us from a long, cold distance away. The moon will still be here when they come out, I thought. The moon and the hills, at least. The opening led us into a winding passage that ran steeply downhill for perhaps a mile. It was hard going for me. My legs are not strong anymore. We moved very slowly. The last part was the worst. A rocky slope where it was easy to miss your footing and slip. This led down to a pool. By the shore of the pool, our group of aged pioneers gathered. Motorboats were waiting here for us, equipped with lanterns. When it's time for people to leave this place, is this the way they will come? I asked our pilot, who has a kind face. He said yes. But how will they know there's a way out if no one tells them? I said. How will they know what to do? They're going to have instructions, said the pilot. They won't be able to get at the instructions until the time is right. But when they need them, the instructions will be there. But what if they don't find them? What if they never come out again? I think they will. People find a way through just about anything. That was all he would say. I am writing these notes while our pilot loads the boat. I hope he doesn't notice.
It ends there, said Lina, looking up.
He must have noticed, said Dune. Or she was afraid he would, so she decided to hide it instead of taking it with her.
She must have hoped someone would find it.
Just as we did,
he pondered.
But we might not have, if it hadn't been for Poppy.
No, and we wouldn't have known that we came from here.
The fiery circle had moved up in the sky now, and the air was so warm that they took off their coats. Absently, Dune dug his finger into the ground, which was soft and crumbly.
But what was the disaster that happened in this place? He said. It doesn't look ruined to me.
It must have happened a long, long time ago, said Lina.
I wonder if people still live here.
They sat looking out over the hills, thinking of the woman who had written in the notebook. What had her city been like? Lina wondered. Like Ember, in some way, she imagined. A city with trouble, where people argued over solutions. A dying city. But it was hard to picture a city like Ember, here in this bright, beautiful place. How could anyone have allowed such a place to be harmed?
What do we do now? Asked Lina.
She wrapped the notebook in its covering again and set it aside.
We can't go back up the river and tell them all to come here.
No, we could never make the boat go against that current.
Are we here alone then? Forever?
Maybe there's another way in. Some way that lets you walk down to Ember. Or maybe there's another river that runs the other way. We have candles now. We could cross the unknown regions if we found a way to get there.
This was the only plan they could come up with. So all day long, they searched for another way in. Under the brow of the hill, they found a hole where a stream wandered into the dark. The water was good to drink, but the hole was far too small for them to fit through. There were gullies full of shrubs, and Lina and Dune crawled among the leaves and prickly branches, but found no openings. Bugs buzzed around their ankles and past their eyes. Brown earth stained their hands, and pebbles got into their shoes. Their thick, dark, shabby clothes got all full of prickly things, and since they were much too hot anyhow, they took most of them off. They had never felt such warmth against their skin and such soft air. When the bright circle was at the top of the sky, they sat for a while in the shade of one of the tall plants on the side of the hill, in a place where the thick brush gave way to a clearing. Poppy went to sleep, but Lina and Dune sat looking out over the land. Green was everywhere, in different shades, like a huge, brilliant, gorgeous version of the overlapping carpets back in the rooms of Ember. Far away, Lina saw a narrow gray line curving like a pencil stroke across a sweep of green. She pointed this out to Dune, and both of them squinted hard at it, but it was too far away to see clearly.
Could it be a road? Said Lina.
It could, said Dune.
Maybe there are people here after all.
I hope so, said Dune. There's so much I want to know.
They were still gazing at the far-off bit of gray when they heard something moving in the brush nearby. Leaves rustled. There was a scraping, shuffling sound. They stiffened and held their breath. The shuffling paused and then started up again.
Was it a person? Should they call out?
But before they could decide what to do, a creature stepped into the clearing. It was about the same size as Poppy, only lower to the ground because it walked on four legs instead of two. Its fur was a deep rust red. Its face was a long triangle. Its ears stood up in points, and its black eyes shone. It trotted forward a few steps, absorbed in its own business. Behind it floated a thick, soft-looking tail. All at once, it saw them and stopped. Lina and Dune stayed absolutely still. So did the creature. Then it took a step toward them, paused, tilted its head a little as if to get a better look, and took another step. They could see the sheen of its fur and the glint of light in its eyes. For a long moment, they stayed like this, frozen, staring at one another. Then, unhurriedly, the creature moved away. It pushed its nose among the leaves on the ground, wandering back toward the bushes, and when it raised its head again, they saw that it was holding something in its white teeth, something round and purplish. With a last glance at them, it leapt toward the bushes, its tail sailing, and disappeared. Lina let out her breath and turned to look at Dune, whose mouth was open in astonishment. His voice shaky, he said,
"That was the most wonderful thing I have ever seen, ever in my whole life."
"Yes, and it saw us," Dune said, and Lina nodded. They both felt it. They had been seen. The creature was utterly strange, not like anything they had ever known. And yet, when it looked at them, Some kind of recognition passed between them.
I know now, said Dune. This is the world we belong in.
A few minutes later, Poppy woke up and made fretful noises, and Lina gave her the last of the peas in Dune's pack.
What was that, do you think, in the creature's mouth? She asked.
Would it be something we could eat? A fruit of some kind? It looked like the pictures of peaches on cans, except for the color.
They got up and poked around, and soon they came across a plant whose branches were laden with the purple fruits, about the size of small beets, only softer. Dune picked one and cut it open with his knife. There was a stone inside. Red juice ran out over his hands. Cautiously, he touched his tongue to it.
Sweet, he said.
If the creature can eat it, maybe we can too, said Lina. Shall we?
They did. Nothing had ever tasted better. Lina cut the stones out and gave chunks of the fruit to Poppy. Juice ran down their chins. When they had eaten 5 or 6 apiece, they licked their sticky fingers clean and started to explore again. They went higher up the slope they were on, wading through flowers as high as their waists, and near the top they came upon a kind of dent in the ground, as if a bit of the earth had caved in. They walked down into it, and at the end of the dent they found a crack about as tall as a person, but not nearly as wide as a door. Lina edged through it sideways and discovered a narrow tunnel.
Send Poppy through, she called back to Dune, and come yourself.
But it was dark inside, and Dune had to go back to where he'd left his pack to get a candle. By candlelight, they crept along until they came to a place where the tunnel ended abruptly. But it ended not with a wall, but with a sudden huge nothingness that made them gasp and step back. A few feet beyond their shoes was a sheer, dizzying drop. They looked out into a cave so enormous that it seemed almost as big as the world outside. Far down at the bottom shone a cluster of lights.
It's ember, Lina whispered.
They could see the tiny, bright streets crossing each other, and the squares, little chips of light, and the dark tops of buildings. Just beyond the edges was the immense darkness.
Oh, our city, Dune. Our city is at the bottom of a hole.
She gazed down through the gulf, and all of what she had believed about the world began to slowly break apart.
We were underground, she said. Not just the pipeworks, everything.
She could hardly make sense of what she was saying. Dune crouched on his hands and knees, looking over the edge. He squinted, trying to see minute specks that might be people.
What's happening there, I wonder?
Could they hear us if we shouted?
I don't think so. We're much too far up.
Maybe if they looked into the sky, they'd see our candle, said Lina. But no, I guess they wouldn't. The street lamps would be too bright.
Somehow, we have to get word to them, said Dune.
And that was when the idea came to Lina.
Our message, she cried. We could send our message.
And they did. From her pocket, Lina took the message that Dune had written, the one that was supposed to have gone to Clary, explaining everything. In small writing, they squeezed in this note at the top. Dear people of Ember, we came down the river from the pipeworks and found the way to another place. It is green here and very big. Light comes from the sky. You must follow the instructions in this message and come on the river. Bring food with you. Come as quickly as you can. Lina Mayfleet and Dune Harrow. They wrapped the message in Dune's shirt and put a rock inside it. Then they stood in a row at the edge of the chasm, Dune in the middle holding Poppy's hand and Lina's. Lina took aim at the heart of the city, far beneath her feet. With all her strength, she cast the message into the darkness, and they watched as it plunged down and down.
Mrs. Murdo, walking even more briskly than usual to keep her spirits up, was crossing Harkin Square when something fell to the pavement just in front of her with a terrific thump.
How extraordinary, she thought, bending to pick it up.
It was a sort of bundle. She began to untie it.